You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Carolyn Vandeweel.
And I'm Benedict Jones. This is the Daily Local News for Thursday, April 25th, 2019.
The biggest concern, even with the increase that supposedly would go to teacher pay, an increase in teacher pay, is that we did not say specifically in the budget that this increase goes to a teacher's base salary.
The Indiana Legislature wrapped up a state budget last night. In today's feature report, we'll hear from Bloomington Representative Matt Pierce and State Senator Mark Stoops about that budget bill. That's coming up later in your Daily Local News.
Also coming up in the next half hour, our weekly public opinion feature, Voices in the Street, asks area residents their thoughts on veganism and vegetarianism as a rash of meat contamination sweeps the South. But first, your daily headlines.
Two homeless men have died over the past 2 months in Bloomington. As WFHB's Rasha Kamhawi reports, tomorrow, Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton, City Communications Director Yael Cassander, Shalom Community Center Director the Reverend Forrest Gilmore, and patrons of the homelessness shelter will sleep on the street in order to raise funds for people experiencing homelessness.
Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton and patrons of the Shalom Community Center will sleep on the streets this Friday night. The Solidarity Sleepout aims to raise funding for the area emergency homeless shelter and bring awareness to the experiences of the chronically homeless in Bloomington and the surrounding area. Mayor Hamilton will be joined by City of Bloomington spokesperson Yael Cassander and area contributors on the grounds of the First United Church on East 3rd Street. Reverend Forrest Gilmore is the executive director of the Shalom Community Center. He says this is the first time Shalom Center has hosted a solidarity sleepout.
We work with people experiencing extreme poverty, so most of our clients have minimal to no income at all and struggle with things like hunger, homelessness, healthcare challenges, disabilities, all kinds of, you know, severe struggles. And so we support them from their basic needs, the life essentials like food and shelter and laundry and bathrooms and showers and things like that, but then help them take them from there to, you know, help them with getting food stamps or helping them move back into a home or helping them get a job or helping them get health care or do recovery work or mental health care. We just help them do what they need to do to hopefully get back on their feet.
The dangers of exposure and violence people experiencing homelessness often face will not be an issue for the patrons of the Shalom. But the sleepout comes on the heels of two deaths of transient men who were found in wooded areas in Bloomington. Last month, the body of a 29-year-old man was found in a wooded area on the city's south side. The site is across the street from the community kitchen of Monroe County. The body of another man was discovered on the other side of town from where the mayor and Shalom patrons will be sleeping. Last week, a 42-year-old man was found dead inside a tent in a wooded area off of West 3rd Street. The area is near the Wheeler Mission, an emergency shelter for homeless men. Reverend Forrest Gilmore of the Shalom Shelter says there are about 340 people experiencing homelessness in Bloomington on any given day. The City of Bloomington named homelessness, poverty, drug dependency, and mental illness as the city's major challenges in 2017. The city's Downtown Safety, Civility, and Justice Task Force identified a lack of resources for those experiencing homelessness as a major challenge to addressing homelessness in the downtown. Reverend Gilmore says some progress has been made since then, with the community financing the expansion of weekend hours at the Shalom Center.
One of the biggest things that's happened as far as Shalom services is through the support of the city and the county and other business and foundations. Sponsors in the community, we've been able to open on the weekend, providing day shelter and providing meals on the weekend, breakfast and lunch on the weekend. So we're now open 7 days a week, which has really helped people have a safe place to go during the day so that they can get out of the weather and just have a safe, secure place to be. We've also, around that same time, opened a new housing program called Crawford 2, and which was a housing program for people with disabilities that has led to long-term homelessness. So those both kind of coincided around the same time after we had some pretty serious community challenges a few years back around overdoses and things like that. We still, you know, still have a significant challenge. Severe substance use disorder and severe mental illness continue to be big challenges. Just basic housing affordability and decent wages continue to be real challenges. There's a lot to work on. We definitely made progress, but there's a lot more to go.
The Solidarity Sleepout event starts at 8 p.m. Friday and ends at 8 a.m. the following day. For WFHB, I'm Rasha Kamhawi.
The Monroe County Community School Board wore red shirts to their Monday night meeting. The board's apparel was part of a statewide Red for Ed campaign showing solidarity with MCCSC educators and education advocates who demonstrated at the State House this week for increased education funding, including better pay for teachers. MCCSC has garnered some additional funding through a series of local referendums that increased property taxes by 14 cents. The 2010 referendum yielded $7.5 million for MCCSC, which the board says has funded more than 80 teaching positions, as well as preschool programs and extracurricular activities. The Monroe County Education Association has been supportive of local Red for Ed activities. Speaking in the MCCSC school board meeting on Monday night, MCEA President Paul Farmer said not all school districts enjoy the same level of community support.
I've been everywhere in the state, and there are very, very few communities like ours. It's incredible what our community has done for us. But we also have to recognize we have schools all around the state that are dying. I was talking with a representative today. I was up at the lobby session today, and I just looked at them in their face, and I said, you understand a lot of our rural schools will die. Between Bloomington and Terre Haute, we're going to have schools that will just disappear because they can no longer function. They can no longer, there's no funding for them whatsoever.
The MCCSC School Board approved a resolution in support of the Red for Ed movement, read aloud by MCCSC Superintendent Judy DeMuth.
Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of School Trustees of the Monroe County Community School Corporation supports our educators and stands ready to take steps necessary to improve salaries and working conditions for our district employees. Be it further resolved that the Board of School Trustees of the Monroe County Community School Corporation supports our school employees as they engage in legal activities that clearly make known their demands concerning necessary funding for meaningful teacher and support staff raises and increased funding, and that the Board of School Trustees of the Monroe County Community School Corporation urges the Indiana General Assembly and Governor to work urgently on behalf of the children and families in our state to take swift and meaningful action to pay teachers and support staff increased professional salaries.
The next meeting of the MCCSC School Board is scheduled for May 14th.
Officials with the City of Bloomington are engaging financial advisors for the Convention Center expansion. On Tuesday, the Food and Beverage Tax Advisory Board approved using tax proceeds to hire public finance law firm Barnes and Thornburg and consulting CPAs Crone and Associates. Deputy Mayor Mick Renizen explained the two firms' responsibilities.
So these two entities together would be the group that estimates the amount of bond capacity we'll have with the food and beverage tax from the city side, identifies any other funding sources that might be required if there are additional costs related to the project, and brings that information forward as the project moves along.
City of Bloomington Controller Jeff Underwood confirmed the engagement letters for both firms and specify their work will relate exclusively to the Convention Center expansion. Renizen said the cost of engaging both firms is not to exceed $200,000. The Bloomington City Council will also have to approve the expenditure. Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton also sits on the Food and Beverage Tax Advisory Board. Hamilton said the food and beverage tax is generating revenue at a healthy pace.
Over the last 12 months, we averaged about $270,000 a month of revenue. That's kind of from April 18 through March 19. That's good. That's a number that's would generate over $3 million a year.
Renizon said most of the revenue spent to date has come out of the city's distribution. The city receives 90% of food and beverage tax revenues. Monroe County receives 10%. Bloomington Deputy Mayor Renizon and Monroe County Attorney Jeff Cockrell updated the board on a recent three-day convention center design charrette. Renizon said the focus was site planning.
The steering committee met last week. There were 3 days of design charrettes that were held in collaboration and all conducted by the architectural firm Convergence and Smith Associates. Open public forums, a very drop-in style all 3 days where members of the public stopped in while drawings were being done that reflected input, and the drawings were done on all of the sites available for the expansion of the convention center. So the plan was to try to identify the best options for locating the exhibit hall, the meeting room space, the parking structures, potential hotel or hotels, all the amenities that go around and connecting those to the existing convention center.
Cockrell said the charrette's final day resulted in 4 design proposals, with several providing good sight lines from the county courthouse.
The final round all had the kind of the convention center on the parcel just north of the current convention center, and the anchor hotel on the parcel between College and Walnut. So I think even with all the renditions, and again, I think they had 4 different ways to do it at the end, they were all pretty consistent on where those two things were going. I think the final day also showed where what we can get with our current budget, what we would have to do in order to get kind of something more expansive. So I think those were extremely interesting. I know that the architect is going through kind of some mechanics of cleaning it up, and it'll soon be on the Convention Center blog site. So you and the public can look at it and see kind of what the final few options are.
Cockrell said some proposed designs include an arts garden. Another would close off 3rd Street between Madison Street and South College Avenue. He also said a marketing study being conducted by a private marketing firm will be key to any next steps.
Just to kind of see if this is built, what's the market look like on what can the expectations be? And I think that's a big component of this as well. And I don't want that to be overshadowed by look where all the buildings are going to go, because the driver of that is also being looked at very thoroughly.
Renizon said the Convention Center Steering Committee will take a deeper look at the cost estimates and site plans as they develop, comparing them against the food and beverage tax revenue.
Like everybody who's built anything, we want more than we can afford, and I'm sure we'll have to come to terms with what's best for the community and best for the resources.
Renizon said he expects there will be more public engagement as the design process unfolds. The architects are expected to return in May with a more structured site design.
Monroe County Surveyor Tron Enright Randolph is debuting a new online survey utility as part of an effort to restructure the county's GIS offerings. Enright Randolph says the app is a one-stop shop for people researching county properties. Enright Randolph reviewed the app with the Monroe County Council in a work session yesterday. The survey utility is accessed through the county surveyor's webpage.
As you explore the county, you can kind of go into where we're currently working with our PS, and as you zoom in, these labels will start to populate, and you'll see the sections that you're currently working in. And each one of these is a document that's linked that will take you to the monument record. So when private surveyors are in the field working, they can access this information. That's critical, because if you got a crew out there, a surveyor that's licensed can send their crew out and they can kind of try to do the job there. And maybe they don't have this information on hand. And the next thing you know, you're dealing with roving corners, which most people will identify as a property dispute. We're not into property rights. We're setting out the grid where this is the point of beginning for surveyors to determine that.
The surveyor's office has completed an extensive online archiving project to make plat records and other survey documents available through the utility. Other components of the utility offer information on fire protection districts, tax increment finance districts, and proposed parks projects. And Wright Randolph said the utility can also show voting precincts and polling sites when given a street address. The link to the voting precinct's interactive map can be found at the county's website under the heading Recent News. That's co.monroe.in.gov. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Carolyn Vandeweel.
And I'm Benedict Jones. Support for WFHB is provided by attorneys Eric Slodegraff and Ben Niehoff. Slodegraff Niehoff is located at 200 East 3rd Street in downtown Bloomington, assisting families in small businesses in meeting the legal challenges of life, providing estate planning and wills, as well as family law services. More information is available at 812-332-6000 or at slodegrafflegal.com. Slodegraff Niehoff, law for business, community, and life.
The 2019 legislative session of the Indiana General Assembly ended yesterday evening. Lawmakers in Indianapolis passed a two-year budget. As WFHB News Director Wes Martin reports, the state's biennial budget includes spending increases in education and for the state's overwhelmed Department of Child Services. But area Democrats say it still falls short.
The state legislature passed a $35 billion two-year budget in Indianapolis last night. That budget passed along party-line votes yesterday, as Democrats derided the state's largest increase to education funding in 11 years as too little, too late. Bloomington Representative Matt Pierce and State Senator Mark Stoops, both Democrats, voted against House Bill 1001, the state budget bill. Representative Pierce says this year's 2.5% increase in state funding for education isn't mandated to go to teacher pay.
The disappointment about that was that despite a lot of talk about improving teacher pay, there was really not any money put in the budget that would address that. There's a little bit of a pension thing that got adjusted that will provide a little bit more money to local corporations that the legislature is hoping will be put into teacher pay, but that really didn't get done. There's nothing in the budget that requires teachers to receive a pay increase. That's up to the local officials. But the problem is the legislature really hasn't provided much more than additional money to keep up with the rate of inflation. And particularly if you back out of the overall 2.5% or whatever the Republicans are saying they have provided to schools, you have to back out of that money that's going to private school vouchers. They include that in that amount, charter schools, which technically are public schools, but often siphon money away from the traditional public schools. And then you have these things called virtual charter schools, which are online schools. And so when you start backing out that kind of money, it drops down to maybe 2.1%. And then when you look at the actual formula that's used to allocate money to the different school corporations, there are many school corporations who actually get less. So in our example, for example, Martinsville is going to end up with less money for their schools. Here in the Monroe County Community School District, which is within my legislative district, they actually don't do too badly. They get like about 2.5 to 3%, depending upon the year. And so that, I think, is mainly because if your school picks up a few additional students, has a little bit of growth or manages to stay level with your student population, then you can kind of maintain your funding. But if you're a rural school or maybe an inner city school that's losing population because people are moving out to the suburbs or going different places, such as a private school, then you're going to lose money.
State Senator Stoops also voted against the Republican-backed House Bill 1001, due to what he calls the minor increases in public education spending. Stoops says the increases in education spending are largely increases in voucher, private, and charter schools, while public schools face budget increases consistent with inflation levels.
There was an increase in funding for schools, but yes, it was barely more than the inflation rate. And unfortunately, when the legislature and the governor over the past 10-plus years have talked about how much money they give to schools, they just put it as a lump sum. So in this case, it's a little over $700 million. Sounds like a lot for the schools, but that means the increase doesn't keep up with inflation. So after cuts back around 2010 or so of $300,000 a year, the schools have never caught up. And the reason is that besides that funding not being brought back in, every increase, every budget, we basically are funding schools at the inflation level. So they're just making do. At the same time, we take away funds for private religious schools. So in this bill, or I'm sorry, in this budget, we're funding private religious schools to the tune of $200 million a year. So that's pretty significant. The increase just in this biennium is about $40 million. So originally that voucher program was supposed to go to special low-income families only. Every year it expands. Now anybody can have access to those vouchers, and most of the children that are going or that are receiving these vouchers have never ever been to public school. So it's just kind of a handout to the private religious schools, and they don't have the same restrictions. They can choose who they allow in. They're not required to teach the same educational standards. For instance, they don't teach evolution. They teach creationism, as an example. There's also certain biases built in. For instance, there were a couple of teachers were fired at a religious school that receives vouchers in Indiana because they were in a same-sex marriage. We tried to pass a bill saying that these schools could not discriminate, but that failed to pass. The biggest concern, even with the increase that supposedly would go to teacher pay, an increase in teacher pay, is that we did not say specifically in the budget that this increase goes to a teacher's base salary. There is money there that schools could use to increase teacher salaries, but they could also use it for other needs. And since they're underfunded, then that presents a difficulty for them. Hopefully the money will go to teacher base salaries, because our teacher salaries in this state are 51 out of 50 states. We pay our teachers the lowest out of any state in the country. And I'm not quite sure how that jives with our stated intent of attracting more people to teach.
Last night's passing of the state's two-year budget retains a $2 billion surplus. It will be up to Indiana school board districts to decide how budgetary increases are allocated in their schools. For WFHB, I'm Wes Martin.
Support for WFHB comes from MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
And up next, our weekly public opinion segment, Voices in the Street.
Welcome to Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion feature. Voices in the Street provides an opportunity for people in our community to share their opinions and perspectives on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents.
In the recent days, an E. coli outbreak was reported at a meat processing facility in Georgia. The poor quality of meat throughout the United States has led many to ponder the idea of veganism. Voices in the Street went out to ask area listeners on their opinions regarding the concept of veganism. How do you feel about veganism?
I mean, veganism, if you do it right, can be healthy. I think protein has an important part of our diet. I mean, through evolution, we have canines for a reason in order for us to eat meat. But I think it should be way less. Obviously, it's having a bad impact on the environment. So I think it depends how you do it. I think you can eat meat well and be good for the environment. I think you can be a vegan and do it well and good for the environment. So I don't think one's necessarily inherently evil over the other.
No, I wouldn't be a vegan. And it's something to be very careful about because I enjoy meat.
I think it's pretty cool. I'm not a vegan myself.
Do you feel that it has any like health benefits or benefits towards the environment?
Yeah, probably.
How so?
Factory farming has probably a lot of environmental harms in terms of carbon emissions, and in terms of like runoff and antibiotics entering the water supply, those sorts of things. They're probably health benefits because vegetables are probably good for you, and eating more vegetables seems like a good thing.
It's fine with me. Well, I know, you know, that it's healthy to have a vegetarian diet. So I think, you know, vegan would probably be even more so.
Would you consider being vegan?
I've thought a lot about being vegetarian, but I'm not so sure about vegan.
I feel like it's a great concept. Morally speaking, it's very pure. Yeah, whatever the opposite for selfish is, whatever that word is, selfless. Yeah, it's pretty selfless. My benefits, I can't really speak on the health benefits, but, you know, obviously, I guess humans' existence have a negative impact on things they consume and eat and, you know, cultivate. So obviously, without that added part, there would be less of that conflict, I guess, conflict slash destruction, if you want to put it so harshly. But other than that, I can't really speak on the health benefits, however.
Would you consider veganism?
I would consider it. I wouldn't be a vegan, however.
Well, I'm vegetarian. Soon I'm planning to become vegan. I think it's good in general for the environment. I just know that it's better for the environment.
Why did you consider being vegetarian?
Because of the environment.
What do you feel that it helps the environment with?
Reduction of CO2. Yeah. The meat production is very inefficient. We can find a lot of studies confirming that. So I decided to contribute to reduction of CO2 in the air.
I think veganism is pretty rad. Like, to live like that, especially in a society where meat and cheese and dairy is such a well-known project, I think it's a good thing, you know? Especially with the red meat industry kind of destroying our ozone layer, going vegan's a good idea.
So I think some of the underlying intentions for veganism is are very good. And I think that it's very possible to be a healthy vegan. But I think there's some underlying misunderstandings that most people don't seem to be aware of. And not just for veganism, but just overall nutrition in general. I actually work with a doctor and have been learning from him for years now. And he actually wrote a book that's in the Smithsonian as a national treasure. It's called The Diseases of Exotic Animals. And it's based on millions of dollars of work that he did doing autopsies on animals and humans. And he has a lot of very solid understanding on nutrition and a big track record. So I can tell you, based on his research and other research that I've looked at, I think veganism can be very healthy, but you need to make sure not to ignore the micronutrients, in particular minerals, because here's the thing. Plants only need three nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. We need way more than that as human beings. With an animal's having animal products in the diet will at least probably give you more of a chance to get those. So vegans need to be extra careful about that. And not just vegans, though, even meat eaters. I personally believe that in this day and age, especially, people need to supplement.
This has been Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion segment, featuring candid commentary from your friends and neighbors on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents. Voices in the Street is a volunteer-powered production of our News and Public Affairs Department here on WFHB 91.3 and 98.1 FM, community radio for South Central Indiana.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Andrew McKieran and Rasha Kamhawi, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Wes Martin.
Voices in the Street was produced by Isaac Gonzalez. Our engineer today is Kevin Oliver, with help from Tal Rothenberg. Our theme music is provided by Ben Lumstein, Scotch Mapke, and Danny Graff. For WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Carolyn Vanderweel. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered independent daily news program.
Stay tuned for Big Talk with Michael Glab, a WFHB news and public affairs program highlighting the issues, events, and people in South Central Indiana. That's coming up next here on WFHB.